Hello, this is Pat Lynch, and you are listening to the Career Pathways Podcast. We come to you weekly and bring you all kinds of interesting guests, mostly Lion faculty and staff. Today, we have a special guest, Dr. Stephanie Sanders. And I always get this wrong, but I'm going to say you are the assistant professor of Spanish.
Associate professor.
Right? Associate. Yes. Okay. Okay. So that, I knew I was going to get that wrong.
Okay.
And then trying to recover from a grievous mistake, I'll flip it over and have our producer say hello.
Hola. It's producer Jason. I'm on camera this time. We're trying a three-camera setup now, so hopefully it kind of looks all right.
Breaking new ground.
Breaking it in.
Stephanie, welcome.
Thank you.
We always start the show just real general thing about just kind of tell us about you, you know, just about yourself. I think you are the first Lion alum that we've had on the show. So that's, you know, so.
No, we had Dr. Perkins, right? Dr. Perkins is alum.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Okay. I thought you said we weren't going to fact check.
No. Okay. That's a good one. That's a good one. That was really good.
All right. But welcome. So tell us about yourself.
Well, thank you all for having me today. Really excited to be here. So I am a Lion alumna from over 20 years ago. And I graduated here in 2002 with a Spanish and psychology major. Moved off to Chile and about a dozen other countries over the 20 years while I was gone.
Yeah.
Lived in three different states.
Sometimes
teaching, sometimes working in companies, kind of different. That have had lived many lives in some ways.
Yeah.
And I'm just excited to be back here, starting my third year here at Lion.
Oh, that's excellent. You know, so what kind of jobs were you doing as far as work, you know, when you were
working? So in Chile, I was a visiting researcher in residence at one point. And then after that, I worked for a year. This is my only year outside of academia, actually, but for a company that worked with antimicrobial copper. And I worked with some of their marketing and talking with Kimberly-Clark and Codelco and some of the big companies. Mm-hmm. So something that I felt like my liberal arts education prepared me well for, because it was really out of my wheelhouse, to say the least. But it was a great experience. So.
And so your chosen field of study is language studies. Yes.
Yes. Hispanic studies is what I have my PhD in,
right,
and specifically literature and popular culture are the two areas that I specialized in. So, yeah, I was very outside my field, to say the least.
When did you get an interest in terms of teaching Spanish?
Mm-hmm. Well, I always wanted to be a teacher, and I came to Lion wanting to study something else. And I was in the obligatory Spanish class, right? Yeah. And like all my required classes, at some point in my life, I was like, oh, now I know why I was taking
that.
So the puzzle fits together. Basically, I'd always loved to learn about other cultures, always loved language, literature, but I was in a classroom here and fell in love with it and just couldn't get enough. So kept going.
Well, this is a podcast that we talk about careers.
Mm-hmm.
So someone who wants to major in language studies, kind of what advice would you give them, and kind of what kind of career opportunities are out there? Because it seems like you had a pretty full career before just finally arriving at, okay, I want to be a professor.
Mm-hmm. I would say that languages, they're a great area, no matter what one's language, one's study is. So it's a great double major to have.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's really no major that can't have a nice compliment with a language double major. So it definitely helps us to be better communicators, but it really helps with job skills, like, you know, working as global citizens, empathetic citizens, those kinds of things. So the advice I would give students is do what they love with it. So, you know, to put the time, we become good at what we, where we put our time. And so, you know, for some students, the, you know, that may be listening to podcasts in Spanish and watching, you know, Netflix and those kinds of things, like bathing one's ear and getting, you know, as much of it as that they can. I think that's a really great way to get competence in the language.
Well, kind of taking that a step further, what is the most effective way to learn a second language?
I think it really depends on the person. And I oftentimes, you know, I ask students often to come to my office so we can kind of do a bit of a diagnostic to see what works best with them. Immersion is always great. So, you know, being immersed in the culture, the language, that's a great thing. I think that college language study does provide a really good foundation so that one is making sense of that, you know, and so that's really effective. It's I've nothing against Duolingo. I think anything that gets someone using the language is great. I'm yet to meet someone who feels confident in their speaking skills through extended use of Duolingo. I have, however, over the years met people in Chile and Puerto Rico and other places, you know, I'll say, wow, your language is really great. And they'll say, I learned through Mickey Mouse or Michael Jackson, right? Like they've bathed, they've really taken in our culture. And I think that that's, you know, that's a very effective way. If students are enjoying it, you know, when they're putting in the time, then it helps a lot. So
I don't think Duolingo goes in depth enough. That's the problem. Like when you're learning like the beginning of the language, I think Duolingo is amazing. Because, like, when you're learning how things work, like, for example, in French, like, how things work, it makes it so much easier to kind of understand. But the intermediate and advanced versions of Duolingo fall off so hard. Because a lot of times when you're trying to study a language, you need to learn, like, terms. And you need to know how those terms work and how they work with each other. And Duolingo doesn't do that. They'll give you, like, the option if you want to look at words. But, like, they'll just repeat the same type of phrases and words over and over and over. So like you'll be really good at asking where my dog is, but you're gonna have no idea, you know, how to ask like where is the cafe or where is so and so, you know.
How to construct those. Yeah, absolutely. I think that before the pandemic there was a bit of a scare of like, oh, programs like Duolingo or the online situation is going to replace, you know, and I think that we learned very quickly that that's not the case. It's hard to replace it. I tell students on language study, I do a lot of sports metaphors, which I probably like stumble on when I do them. But basically with language study, it's something that, you know, it is a skill. You can't cram for it. And so it's best to do it in small, manageable chunks. And so if they're putting in the 2 hours that they're supposed to be for every hour in the class, six extra hours a week, probably going to accidentally learn the language, right? Yeah. So, but I wouldn't suggest anybody sit down and study Spanish for 6 hours because they're just going to, you know, it's not going to work. And so to, you know, put their timer on their phone, do 20 minutes without any distractions, and then go get a coffee or a tea or something to reward themselves and, you know, do something else, that kind of thing. But
why do so many people just convince themselves, I cannot learn a second language? It's like kind of math phobia in a way. And I think, and I don't know if it's just people here in the U.S. or if this is like the same other parts of the world. I tend to think of it more like as a U.S. Situation because we're in, you know, we really aren't kind of connected in the same way like people in Europe or South America. I mean,
you're absolutely right. The second that I've tell people that I'm a Spanish professor, it's like, wait for it. Because I know the response. There's going to be the confessional. Yeah. So it's like this trauma that has happened, you know, oh, I took this many years and all I learned was the colors and the numbers and now I can't speak it. You know, like they feel something they need to get off. It causes a lot of stress, I think, like in the classroom, and there's different reasons, I think, for that. But and the other response that I get all the time is, oh, if I had it to do over, you know, from like doctors, medical professionals.
Yeah, me.
Yeah, everybody. If I had it to do over, oh, I wish I would have paid attention to my language classroom, you know. So it's something that in the classroom, we have a term called the effective filter. So just trying to lower that as much as possible, the stress, you know, because everybody gets kind of the sweaty palms, the racing heartbeat. I try to help students to just feel comfortable and like I'm not going to jump on them the second that they make a mistake. I also put some, you know, Bad Bunny or something in the background when they're working in small groups so they don't feel so self-conscious. And also, I'm hopeful that one of the music choices I put on, they'll listen to while they're working out later or something like that. But it just trying to get people to feel as comfortable as possible helps. Also, you know, I think as Americans, if we can realize people are really happy when we learn about their culture you know, take the time to learn the language. And then most of the time they're not there to just like jump on us and say, oh, you're not doing it right. You know, maybe to help, but they're happy with the attempt for sure.
When you hear like somebody like they're, well, I'll kind of rephrase it, to really be able to go back and forth between languages, do you have to begin thinking in that language or do you hear it like as English and then translate it in your mind, or are you like, can you shift and just say, okay, I'm going to be in Spanish?
I definitely shift now completely. Sometimes so my husband's from Puerto Rico, and in our house, since we both are very fluent in both languages, sometimes I'll catch us and we'll be sliding in and out of both languages. Right. Like I don't have the, oh, I'm speaking in English now, or I'm speaking in Spanish. And so, cause I know he's going to understand me. And so we kind of slip back into both very,
what language do you curse in?
Definitely Spanish.
There you go.
Yeah. I've got a sailor's tongue in Spanish in different countries, even in different regional variations.
All right. So like for somebody learning, what's, you know, is that part of the difficulty as far as, it's like a however fast or slow it's taking them to process.
And I think a couple of things that are really helpful, having a sense of humor, like knowing that one is going to mess up, and also being okay with not understanding everything. And that's a hard thing to give over, you know, because we want to look up every single word and then that's just exhausting. Sometimes we have to, you know, be okay with gradually putting that puzzle together. So I think that part, you know, really helps. I mean, some of my favorite things that I can't wait for when students will come and tell me like, oh, you know, something weird happened last night. I'm like, okay, what happened? I dreamt in Spanish, you know? And so that's always well, congratulations. That's your milestone.
Right.
You were really fluent when you were dreaming, right? And they're like, I was. I'm like, it's all up there, right? So sometimes we're the ones that are kind of, you know, putting the limitations, but there's so much regional differences too with the countries, you know, so I try to expose students to listening to Spanish from Cuba and from, you know, Spain and all the different areas and trying to help them, you know, hear those different differences so they're less intimidating one day.
Where is it in terms of in the level of mastery when you can begin writing in a second language?
That's a good question. I think for many students that comes earlier than the speaking. I would say over the last many years of teaching, I've only had outside of heritage speakers that grew up with the language, only a handful of students that would say I feel more comfortable speaking than I do writing. So I think that comes earlier. Now, different types of writing, right. it somewhat depends. You know, my PhD being in Spanish, there are certain things that I feel more comfortable writing in Spanish, like if I'm going to do theory or something like that, right? Yeah. So that, because that was the language that I learned those things in first. The writing part will often come before the speaking, for sure.
Yeah. Really?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. I would have thought just the opposite, you know, because I typically, like K through 12 instructions, mostly.
Yes, that's true.
Oral.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
That's a good point. But it is that flooding of, mm-hmm. you know, flooding the ear. The more they can read, the more they can listen to, you know, it eventually, it starts to come out. The other thing, sorry to circle back around, but you were asking like what students can do. I would also say students at Lyon can definitely volunteer in the community. That was something that I did as a student here. Was very active volunteering, and that helps tremendously. Plus, it's just really rewarding. Yeah, you know,
what volunteer opportunities are there in the local area?
Yeah, so at the local schools, there are opportunities to work with ESL at the Ozark Foothills Literacy.
We just sent a group there. It was like a week ago. It was great. And we'll talk about, I think it was your honor students that all, it was like 10 of them.
Yes, it was. Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Great. Yeah. I'm so proud of them. Yeah. Yeah. They did great at the Fairy Tale Festival.
I was talking to a couple of the representatives, we're at our career expo, and they said there's several students who want to continue volunteering, which is exactly what you want.
Yeah. Yeah. They're a great group. So,
yeah. Now, the Ozark Literacy Project, is that like English as a second language? Is that?
It's both. So, yes. It helps adults with reading. Mm-hmm. So it can be, you know, reading in English as a native speaker of English, or also they offer ESL.
Kind of a global question. Why is it that, like, called like mandatory second language is just something that is not like required in education. It's still, I think, considered an elective. And I know my daughter, she was in French.
Mm-hmm.
She ended up being a theater kid. And with her, the way her schedule was, she had to choose between French and theater.
It was
terrible. She wanted to do both, but she just couldn't. And it's like, you know, then they, but that's the way they structured it. And what's kind of the reason why,
mm-hmm.
you know, like teaching, you could choose, you know, French, Spanish, mm-hmm. what mm-hmm. some schools offer other languages as well. Why is it that the U.S. doesn't do a better job in that area?
Yeah, it's a good question. I'm not completely sure why it is. I could definitely speculate. I think that, you know, even with our large immigration communities historically, right, there, you know, we've gone through periods of where people have said, okay, you only speak to your child in English so that they will, you know, know the language and there won't be that interference. I mean, we know now that's not the case, right? So children are so much more capable of many at the same time, right? We've had more of that assimilation type mm-hmm. focus, I feel like, instead of saying, okay, let's celebrate the fact that we've got all of these, you know, and we really want to be able to communicate. Plus, you know, they're in certain areas, French and Spanish mm-hmm. were the native languages of the regions of the states, right? So, or a version of those. So, yeah. But it's certainly something we haven't placed the focus and even prestige. I think there are, you know, parts of the world where it's something that, you know, it's like, oh, you only speak one language, you know, but that's not the case for
us.
Well,
if you travel, you know, internationally, it is, at least, you know, for me, it's always been a little bit of an embarrassment. No, really, that I'm just limited to English, which, you know, it sounds, you know, for people who never leave the States, that what? You know, yeah. But yeah, it's just, you feel like, you know, here are these, you meet these people that have more than one, two, yeah. three mm-hmm. languages that they can, you know, shift back and forth. And,
yeah.
It comes down to the state level. Yes. The state level is the biggest issue. Is
I'll say more.
Well, the education system in the United States is very much not federalized as much as it should be. So because there's not an exact federal standard, yeah. mm-hmm. the U.S. can't say, all right, everybody needs to have at least like 4 years of language like they do in Germany. Like in yeah. Germany, they have to do I used to play with these guys on a professional video game team, and they had to do 4 years of English uh-huh. throughout high school from like their like ninth grade through their 12th grade. In the United States, we don't do that. And that's the biggest issue yeah. is each state, like in Minnesota, we have to do 2 years of language,
uh-huh.
right? But in, let's just say, I don't know, South Dakota, they don't have to do any requirements.
That's true. That's the biggest issue. True.
Now, yeah. In Arkansas, is there any language requirement?
Yes, we do have students, though, that come from different states that haven't, like, they're, you know, taking, because I was teaching at a school in Ohio for 12 years before I came here. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was mainly students from there. And so here right. at Lyon, we have so many students from different states, which is right. amazing. But yeah, I've definitely had some students that's like, this is my first day of a language ever, you know, which is yeah, like, it's yeah. really, really hard.
Right.
But that's, it is something that really depends on the state.
Yeah.
And I've seen states shift over the years right. too. So that was,
And it's almost politicized too, which is kind of a bad thing.
Yes,
it shouldn't be.
Yeah,
especially like when a lot of states have a very large migrant population that doesn't speak English. Mm-hmm. And I know like this is coming back again to like Minnesota, but in Minnesota they wanted to start putting on signs like making them like bilingual, mm-hmm. Specifically with Spanish because mm-hmm. we have such a large Spanish speaking population. And everyone flipped out. Like everybody right. flipped out and was like, that's so unneeded. If they're coming to the United States, they should just try to be able to read English. And it's
Simulate,
like,
yeah.
but
yeah.
then again, we also don't have a national language. So it's like,
yeah.
what
yeah.
do you want to be? Do you want to be a country that only speaks English and have a national language? Or do you want to be a country that speaks all these languages mm-hmm. and accommodates for all of them?
Yes. So. Yeah. And it never erases one's first language. Yeah. On the contrary, it makes it so much more rich. Like, I feel yeah. like I've fallen in love with, you know, like I fell in love with Latin American literature before mm-hmm. I did Southern literature, oh, you know, just yeah. so it's sometimes it makes us really appreciate our own culture and it makes us better writers and communicators and yeah. in our first language. It never robs us of it, you know. Excellent. So, yeah.
Speaking of literature, you'll love that segue. You wrote a children's book?
Yes. Yes.
Tell yeah. us about it.
So I wrote the children's book way before I had my daughter, but I was actually living in Chile working at
microbial.
Yes, there we go.
Yes.
Company for copper. Chile's a big copper producer. Mm-hmm. And so it's my first only year actually away from literature and academia. Mm-hmm. And I think it was also before Libby and some like the access to just like right. books. Right. So I was living there and just really needing a creative outlet.
Right.
And so that's how that came about.
Well, what's the book? Tell us about the book.
So the, it's Fabia the Fabulous Goes to Work, and it's, mm-hmm. it's just kind of a fun story of a little Westie that tries on different jobs, you know, mm-hmm. and it was the first of a series that the other books were going to look at, you know, the Atacama Desert and the Pyrenees and some other places yeah. that I've traveled to, but kind of getting kids exposed to travel regions, maybe yeah, where yeah. they wouldn't have seen before and textiles, which I love to work with. So, my illustrator, who's wonderful, she's in graduate school right now. So mm-hmm. I don't know, you know, if the other books will eventually come into print or not. But
well,
yeah,
Tasia Showers.
Yes, she's one of my students. She's
okay,
wonderful.
And she's doing illustration for a children's book.
Okay,
right now.
Great.
Yeah, talk to her.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, shameless plug. But, you know, but no, that's so. This you have like book one of the series, is that or
yes, I've know? Got a couple more written, but they're just not illustrated because I unfortunately I can't can't illustrate. So yeah.
Oh, no, that's now is has it been banned in any libraries at this point?
Not
that's
yet.
A badge of honor.
No, it's it's not that scandalous or anything. But yeah.
Well, you have time. You can work on that. You know, just get yourself on one of these lists. Well, that's great. Yeah. Not another dramatic change of subject. Uh-huh. Honors program.
Yes.
This is your first year. And now, is it the head of the honors program, or sort of like a formal title?
Yeah. Yes, the director of honors. So my first
of honors.
Year is that. Yes.
Okay.
I worked with Dr. Wesley Bill last year as the associate director and really loved working with the group. And I'm honored to be, I mean, it sounds cheesy, but it's true.
No pun intended. Yeah.
To be working with them this year.
Well, what is it?
Yes.
Honors program.
So it's a learning community. Students enter the honors program typically is a freshman, though we do have some that enter as sophomores or transfer students. They live together their first year in a cohort. And then throughout the next 4 years, there are a couple honors classes that they take. There are some, there's a capstone course that they have. And then there's lots of high impact learning practices like research and travel. We do a lot of activities, usually every, if we don't have something every week, it's every other week and sometimes twice a week, but lots of activities that kind of go between, you know, learning ones of listening to speakers come in, but also just having fun. Like we're pretty competitive. So scavenger hunts and trivia nights and those kinds of things. We like to eat together a lot. And so, yeah.
Yeah. And I, now that was the, is that the honors class that, that I met with? The
Yes. Yeah. So the honors students this year, I'm so, so proud of them, but they are working on a textile project. And so they've created a committee within the group that's working on sustainability. Last year after after the faculty colloquium, one of the students approached me about that. And so they're working on a textile mural, and then they're also doing lots of volunteer work in the community. And so I'm just really proud of the work that they're doing.
Well, yeah, can we talk about that? Because I remember the colloquium too, and because the whole thing around sustainability goes up against this whole, you know, trend of fast fashion, and you know, now you got Temu and Shein that are just accelerating this move towards just, you know, use it and throw it away, and then it sounds great until you find out where the discarded garments go, and then, you know, then there's a, you know, just this whole element of social justice.
Yes, absolutely.
But it kind of kind of what exactly it happens.
So it's fast fashion has been something, and now there's a term that has it. You said it, and then it just left me. But it's like instant fashion. There's like something that's even faster than fast right?
Yeah, so,
but basically, in recent years, you know, it's gotten where there aren't four seasons of clothing, right? So new garments are being stocked, crammed on the shelves, or, you know, and can buy online every week or two, right? So you can imagine just the sheer number of garments that are happening oftentimes in really unsafe and underpaid positions, right? And so, you know, the quality, we've probably all had something that we've washed and then
falls apart.
Yeah, the seams have come out or something. And so that's always like a concern. And where those discarded clothing items go, or the ones that aren't sold, you know, what happens to those?
Well, so, I just have that image of, it was in your PowerPoint deck of just all this clothes piled up on a shore somewhere.
Yeah.
it just seemed awful, you know?
Yeah, it's, I just published a short piece for a journal with Harvard that was talking about my time in Chile and mm-hmm. the Atacama Desert. And yeah. that's just one of the most beautiful places on earth. I mean, it is just, National Geographic, like picture worthy in every way. And yet there are all these mountains of discarded clothing, you know, and also just the markets of used clothing, which can be good, you know, to help people have access to affordable clothing. And then at the same time, it puts a lot of pressure on the local economies as well and designers. And
yeah, and it's just somewhere through the whole thing, it's an exploitation of the vulnerable, you know, the ones that while we enjoy, an affordable garment, who is it that's making that garment?
How expensive is it really? Yeah. There's a great documentary called The True Cost, and it shows there's one cost that's the price tag, but really at what cost are we getting that garment?
What's your thought as far is faster fashion, is it getting is it accelerating and get in moving in the wrong direction, or are we moving more towards some level of sustainability?
Yeah. I think that many of the companies, of course, there's the term greenwashing, right? Yeah. You know, many of them are taking measures that they originally had not, you mm-hmm. know, whether that's allowing customers to bring back garments and, you know, reusing those what can be recycled.
Patagonia, they have a pretty mm-hmm. active resell market, you know, so you can, turn it back in and mm-hmm. you get a bargain and it isn't being discarded.
Yes, absolutely. And so I think that there's work being done there, work being done on individual levels of movements of minimalism or upcycling, learning to sew and thrifting and all these types of things. Policies, probably something, until that's looked at. And that's not my area of expertise by any means, but it's probably hard to see as many sweeping changes until some of those things happen.
Yeah, the Temu Shein model is actually pretty scary because they do not even make their own clothes. It's mm-hmm. it's basically like a software company that has this amazing algorithm that you just see something online. I like this blouse, and then you add it to your cart, and then the algorithm goes to work to find somewhere, factory mm-hmm. wherever it is in the world that is making that, and then they ship it there, and so this company never touches it, but they just make it super easy to mm-hmm. To buy super cheap.
Exactly.
It's basically drop shipping.
Yeah, yes, and it's absolutely. And so even like Amazon is nervous about them, and Amazon, you always think they're not going to rest till they wipe out every retailer on the planet, and here these guys are coming in, and they're in the crosshairs.
Giving them a run for their money,
it's
something, and it's really hard. Textile waste is more difficult than other types of waste in some ways to know how much is even out there, right? So a number of journalists have done a really great job of exposing like our closets. How much we just tend to hoard. Yeah. Clothing. And so for many kind of emotional reasons or whatever. And mm-hmm. so it's something that it's like, we just don't even know how much is out there. It's a bit daunting. Yeah.
As far as your interest in like, I'll just broadly call it social mm-hmm. justice. Is that mm-hmm. from your just traveling the world?
Yes, for sure. And I think from my upbringing as well, mm-hmm. I was raised, in a town of 1,500 people, and my parents still grow a lot of what they eat, and my mom sewed almost everything that I wore and made my toys and those kinds of things. And so I realized what work went behind things. Yeah. And then when I just started seeing these unreal prices, I thought, this doesn't match up, So there was that, and definitely the exposure of, of traveling and living abroad and seeing different ways of approaching the world and enjoying the world. So,
So for what town was it in or is it in Arkansas?
Salem.
Salem?
One of the several Salems, because I know there are more than one, but it's in Fulton County. It's about an hour from Batesville.
So you have this town of 1,500, and then basically you graduate, you go to line, and then you are off into the world.
6 million of Santiago.
And,
before the days of WhatsApp and, the difficulty of communicating.
Yeah.
It was a very different time.
Yeah.
So my poor parents, they were really good sports and supportive.
Yeah. How did you know it was like the right time to kind of return and come back to Arkansas?
Well, I always tease that, for almost 20 years, I wouldn't shut up about Lyon, right?
Yeah.
I'm sure I annoyed everybody, but I've just always thought this is a really special place. Mm-hmm. I love it. I love the area. And I was working at a terrific place, too, with wonderful people. But when this came open, I thought, in the words of Elvis, it's now or never. And it really was in my career, because it just was at the point, where I was going to stay and finish out where I was, or if it was possible, I was going to come back and try to give back to a place that gave me so much. So, and then I also met somebody who fixed coffee for me the days of my interview, and that helped a lot. So,
this will sound completely inappropriate, but we shared a house together. Actually, I just got hired on. And you were interviewing, right?
Yes, yeah.
And so I became like the house father. And so everybody that would roll through interviewing, I'd be making them coffee and talking to them. And it's like, trying to.
It helps. It always helps. And, without coffee, I don't function in the morning.
I got to meet everybody was rolling. I was the welcoming committee.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
that was our first time.
Yeah.
Well, that's a great way to end. But thank you, Stephanie.
All. Thank you. Really appreciate it.
Oh, yes. And thank you for listening to the Career Pathways podcast. Yeah, we come to you each week with a fascinating guest like the one today. And so we hope that you'll continue to listen to us and join us. Before closing, Jason, you there?
Yeah, I'm alive.
Okay, producer Jason, where can you find the Career Pathways podcast?
You can find it on 99.97% of platforms, the same number of germs that get killed with Germex. So it's a little fun.
And we won't fact check one more time.
Yeah.
I've already been called
out. You weren't
going
to fact check this. That was the rules.
That's the rules. All right. But thank you again for listening to the Career Pathways podcast. Come join us next week. Take care.
This broadcast is sponsored in part by Lyon College and by Kilt Studios.